Chapter 99 Galactics. Matters were dire. Consensus was falling apart irreparably, and the suzerain of propriety did not know how to heal the breach. The suzerain of cost and caution had nearly withdrawn into itself. The bureaucracy operated on inertia without guidance. And their vital third, their strength and virility, the suzerain of beam and talon, would not answer their entreaties for a conclave. It seemed, in fact, bound and determined upon a course that might bring on not only their own destruction, but possibly vast devastation to this frail world as well. If that occurred, the blow to the already tottering honor of this expedition, this branch of the clan of Guxiu Gubru, would be more than one could stand. And yet, what could the suzerain of propriety do? The roost masters, distracted with problems closer to home, offered no useful advice. They had counted on the expedition triumvirate to meld, to molt, and to reach a consensus of wisdom. But the molt had gone wrong, desperately wrong, and there was no wisdom to offer them. The suzerain of propriety felt a sadness, a hopelessness, that went beyond that of a leader riding a ship headed for shoals. It was more that of a priest doomed to oversee sacrilege. The loss was intense and personal, and quite ancient at the heart of the race. True, the feathers sprouting under its white down were now red, but there were names for Gubru queens who achieved their femaleness without the joyous consent and aid of two others, two who share with her the pleasure, the honor, the glory. Her greatest ambition had come true, and it was a barren prospect, a lonely and bitter one. The suzerain of propriety tucked her beak under her arm, and, in the way of her own people, softly wept. Chapter 100 Athoclena. Vampire plants, was how Lydia McHugh summed it up. She stood watch with two of her Terrigan's marines, their skins glistening under painted layers of monolayer camouflage. The stuff supposedly protected them from infrared detection, and, one could hope, the enemy's new resonance detector as well.
Vampire plants? Athoclena thought. Indeed, it is a good metaphor.
She poured about a liter of a bright red fluid into the dark waters of a forest pool, where hundreds of small vines came together in one of the ubiquitous nutrient trading stations. Elsewhere, far away, other groups were performing similar rituals in little glades. It reminded Athoclena of wolfling fairy tales, of magical rites in enchanted forests and mystical incantations. She would have to remember to tell her father of the analogy, if she ever got the chance.
Indeed, she said to Lieutenant McHugh. My chims drained themselves nearly white to donate enough blood for our purposes. There are certainly more subtle ways to do this, but none possible in the time available.
Lydia answered with a grunt and a nod. The Earthwoman was still in conflict with herself. Logically, she probably agreed that the results would have been catastrophic had Major Pratha Chilthorn been left in charge weeks ago. Subsequent events had proven Athoclena and Robert right. But Lieutenant McHugh could not dissociate herself so easily from her oath. Until recently, the two women had begun to become friends, talking for hours and sharing their different longings for Robert Oneagle. But now that the truth about the mutiny and kidnapping of Major Pratha Chilthorn was out, a gulf lay between them. The red liquid swirled among the tiny rootlets. Clearly, the semi-mobile vines were already reacting, drawing in the new substances. There had been no time for subtlety, only a brute force approach to the idea that had struck her suddenly, soon after hearing Silvery's report.
Hemoglobin. The Gubru had detectors that can trace resonance against the primary constituent of earthling blood. At such sensitivity, the devices must be frightfully expensive.
A way had to be found to counteract the new weapon, or she might be left the only sapient being in the mountains. The one possible approach had been drastic and symbolic of the demands a nation made of its people. Her own unit of guerrillas now tottered around, so depleted by her demands for raw blood, that some of the Chims had changed her nickname. Instead of the General, they had taken to referring to Athaklana as the Countess, and then grimacing with outthrust canines. Fortunately, there were still a few Chim technicians, mostly those who had helped Robert devise little microbes to plague enemy machinery, who could help her with this slapdash experiment.
Bind hemoglobin molecules to trace substances sought by certain vines. Hope the new combination still meets their approval, and pray the vines transfer it along fast enough.
A Chim messenger arrived and whispered to Lieutenant McHugh. She, in turn, approached Athaklana.
The Major is nearly ready,
the dark human woman told her. Casually, she added,
and our scouts say they detect aircraft heading this way.
Athaklana nodded.
We are finished here. Let us depart. The next few hours will tell.
Chapter 101 Galactics.
There! We know the concentration, gathering, accumulation of the impudent enemy. The wolflings flee in a predictable direction, and now we may strike, pounce, swoop to conquer.
Their special detectors made plain the quarry's converging trails through the forest. The suzerain of Beam and Talon spoke a command, and an elite brigade of Gubru soldiery stooped upon the little valley where their fleeing prey was trapped, at bay.
Captives, hostages, new prisoners to question. These I want.
Chapter 102 Major Prathachulthorn. The bait was invisible. Their lure consisted of little more than a barely traceable flow of complex molecules coursing through the intricate, lacy network of jungle vegetation. In fact, Major Prathachulthorn had no way of knowing for certain that it was there at all. He felt awkward laying enfilade and ambush on the slopes overlooking a series of small ponds in an otherwise unoccupied forest vale. And yet there was something symmetrical, almost poetic, about the situation. If this trick by some chance actually worked, there would be the joy of battle on this morn. And if it did not, then he intended to have the satisfaction of throttling a certain slender alien neck, whatever the effects on his career and his life.
Thing! He snapped at one of his marines. Don't scratch!
The Marine Corporal quickly checked to make sure he had not rubbed off any of the monolayer coating that gave his skin a sickly greenish cast. The new material had been mixed quickly, in hopes of blocking the hemoglobin resonance the enemy were using to track Terrans under the forest canopy. Of course, their intelligence on that matter might be completely wrong. Prathachulthorn had only the word of Chims, and that damned Tim...
Major!
Someone whispered. It was a neo-chimpanzee trooper, looking even more uncomfortable in green-tinted fur. He motioned quickly from midway up a tall tree. Prathachulthorn acknowledged and sent a hand gesture rippling in both directions.
Well, he thought, some of these local Chims are turning into pretty fair irregulars, I'll admit.
A series of sonic booms rocked the foliage on all sides,
followed by the shriek of approaching aircraft. They swept up the narrow valley at treetop level, following the hilly terrain with computer-piloted precision. At just the right moment, Talon soldiers and their accompanying drones spilled out of the long troop carriers to fall serenely toward a certain jungle grove. The trees there were unique in only one way, in their hunger for a certain trace chemical brought to them by far-reaching, far-trading vines. Only now those vines had delivered something else as well, something drawn from earthly veins.
"Wait," Prathachul Thorn whispered. "Wait for the big boys."
Sure enough, soon they all felt the effects of approaching gravitics, and on a major scale. Over the horizon appeared a Gubru battleship, cruising serenely several hundred meters above. Here was a target well worth anything they had to sacrifice. Up until now, though, the problem had been how to know in advance where one would come. Flickers, swivers were wonderful weapons, but not very portable. One had to set them up well in advance, and surprise was essential.
"Wait," he murmured as the great vessel drew nearer. "Don't spook 'em."
Down below, the Talon soldiers were already chirping in dismay, for no enemy awaited them, not even any Chim civilians to capture and send above for questioning. At any moment, one of the troopers would surely guess the truth. Still, Major Prathachul Thorn urged,
"Wait just a minute more, until..."
One of the Chim gunners must have lost patience. Suddenly, lightning lanced upward from the heights on the opposite side of the valley. In an instant, three more streaks converged. Prathachul Thorn ducked and covered his head. Brilliance seemed to penetrate from behind, through his skull. Waves of deja vu alternated with surges of nausea, and for a moment it felt as if a tide of anomalous gravity were trying to lift him from the forest loam. Then the concussion wave hit. It was some time before anyone was able to look up again. When they did, they had to blink through clouds of drifting dust and grit, past toppled trees and scattered vines. A seared, flattened area told where the Gubru battlecruiser had hovered only moments ago. A rain of red-hot debris still fell, setting off fires wherever the incandescent pieces landed. Prathachul Thorn grinned. He fired off a flare into the air, the signal to advance. Several of the enemy's grounded aircraft had been broken by the overpressure wave. Three, however, lifted off and made for the sites where the missiles had been fired, screaming for vengeance. But their pilots did not realize they were facing Terrigan's Marines now. It was amazing what a captured saber rifle could do in the right hands. Soon three more burning patches smoldered on the valley floor. Down below, grim-faced Chims moved forward, and combat soon became much more personal. A bloody struggle fought with lasers and pellet guns, with crossbows and arbalests. When it came down to hand-to-hand, Prathachul Thorn knew that they had won.
"I cannot leave all of the close-in stuff to these locals," he thought.
That was how he came to join the chase through the forest, while the Gubru rear guard furiously tried to cover the survivors' escape. And for as long as they lived thereafter, the Chims who saw it talked about what they saw. A pale green figure in loincloth and beard, swinging through the trees, meeting fully armed Talon soldiers with knife and garrote. There seemed to be no stopping him, and indeed, nothing living withstood him. It was a damaged battle drone, brought back into partial operation by self-repair circuitry, perhaps making a logical connection between the final collapse of the Gubru forces and this fearsome creature who seemed to take such joy in battle. Or maybe it was nothing more than a final burst of mechanical and electrical reflex. He went, as he would have wanted to, wearing a bitter grin, with his hands around a feathered throat, throttling one more hateful thing that did not belong in the world he thought ought to be. Chapter 103. Athaclena.
So,
she thought, as the excited Jim Messenger gasped forth the joyous news of total victory. On any scale, this was the insurgents' greatest coup.
In a sense, Garth herself became our greatest ally, her injured but still subtly powerful web of life.
The Gubru had been lured by fragments of Chim and human hemoglobin, carried to one site by the ubiquitous transfer vines. Frankly, Athaclena was surprised their makeshift plan had worked. Its success proved just how foolish had been the enemy's overdependence on sophisticated hardware.
Now, we must decide what to do next.
Lieutenant McHugh looked up from the battle report the winded Chim messenger had brought and met Athaclena's eyes. The two women shared a moment's silent communion.
I'd better get going,
Lydia said at last.
There'll be reconsolidation to organize, captured equipment to disperse, and I am now in command.
Athaclena nodded. She could not bring herself to mourn Major Prathachulthorn, but she acknowledged the man for what he had been, a warrior.
Where do you think they will strike next?
She asked.
I couldn't begin to guess, now that their main method of tracking us has been blown. They act as if they haven't much time.
Lydia frowned pensively.
Is it certain the Thenanan fleet is on its way here?
Lydia asked.
The Uplift Institute officials speak about it openly on the airwaves. The Thenanan come to claim their new clients, and as part of their arrangement with my father and with Earth, they are bound to help expel the Gubru from this system.
Athaclena was still quite in awe over the extent to which her father's scheme had worked. When the crisis began, nearly one Garth year ago, it had been clear that neither Earth nor Tim Brim would be able to help this faraway colony, and most of the moderate galactics were so slow and judicious that there was little hope of persuading one of those clans to intervene. Uthakalding had hoped to fool the Thenanan into doing the job instead, pitting Earth's enemies against each other. The plan had worked beyond Uthakalding's expectations, because of one factor her father had not known of. The gorillas. Had their mass migration to the ceremonial mound been triggered by the Sustruthun exchange, as she had earlier thought? Or was the Institute's Grand Examiner correct to declare that fate itself arranged for this new client race to be at the right time and place to choose? Somehow Athaclena felt sure there was more to it than anyone knew, or perhaps ever would know.
So the Thenanan are coming to chase out the Gubru.
Lydia seemed uncertain what to make of the situation.
Then we've won, haven't we? I mean, the Gubru can't hold them off indefinitely. Even if it were possible militarily, they'd lose so much face across the five galaxies that even the moderates would finally get upset and mobilize.
The Earthwoman's perceptiveness was impressive. Athaclena nodded.
Their situation would seem to call for negotiation, but that assumes logic. The Gubru military, I'm afraid, is behaving irrationally.
Lydia shivered.
Such an enemy is often far more dangerous than a rational opponent. He doesn't act out of intelligent self-interest. My father's last call indicated that the Gubru are badly divided,
Athaclena said. The broadcasts from Institute territory were now the guerrillas' best source of information. Robert and Fibbon and Uthakalding had all taken turns, contributing powerfully to the mountain fighters' morale and surely adding to the invaders' severe irritation.
"We'll have to act under the assumption the gloves are off, then."
The woman Marine sighed.
"If galactic opinion doesn't matter to them, they may even turn to using space weaponry down here on the planet. We'd better disperse as widely as possible."
Yes,
Athaclena nodded.
"But if they use burners or hell bombs, all is lost anyway. From such weapons we cannot hide." "I cannot command your troops, Lieutenant, but I would rather die in a bold gesture, one which might help stop this madness once and for all, than end my life burying my head in the sand like one of your earthly oysters."
Despite the seriousness of the proposition, Lydia McHugh smiled, and a touch of appreciative irony danced along the edges of her simple aura.
"Ostriches,"
the Earthwoman corrected gently.
"It's big birds called ostriches that bury their heads. Now, why don't you tell me what you have in mind?"
Chapter 104 Galactics. Buwalt of the Thenanin inflated his ridge crest to its maximum height and preened his shining elbow spikes before stepping out upon the bridge of the great warship Athanasphire. There, beside the grand display where the disposition of the fleet lay spread out in sparkling colors, the human delegation awaited him. Their leader, an elderly female, whose pale hair tendrils still gleamed in places with the color of a yellow sun, bowed at a prim, correct angle. Buwalt replied with a precise waistbend of his own. He gestured toward the display.
"Admiral Alvarez, I assume you can perceive for yourself that the last of the enemy's mines have been cleared. I am ready to transmit to the Galactic Institute for Civilized Warfare our declaration that the Gubru interdiction of this system has been lifted by force majeure."
"That is good to hear,"
the woman said, her human-style smile, a suggestive baring of teeth, was one of their easier gestures to interpret. One as experienced with galactic affairs as the legendary Helene Alvarez surely knew the effect the wolfling expression often had on others. She must have made a conscious decision to use it. Well, such subtle intimidations played an acceptable role in the complex game of bluff and negotiation. Buwalt was honest enough to admit that he did it, too. It was why he had inflated his towering crest before entering.
"It will be good to see Garth again," Alvarez added. "I only hope we aren't the proximate cause of yet another holocaust on that unfortunate world."
"Indeed, we shall endeavor to avoid that at all costs. And if the worst happens, if this band of Gubru are completely out of control, then their entire nasty clan shall pay for it."
"I care little about penalties and compensation. There are people and an entire frail ecosphere at risk here."
Buwalt withheld comment. "I must be more careful," he thought. "It is not meet for others to remind Thenanin, defenders of all potential, of the duty to protect such places as Garth." It was especially galling to be chided righteously by wolflings.
"And from now on they will be at our elbows, carping and criticizing, and we will have to listen, for they will be stage consorts to one of our clients. It is only one price we must pay for this treasure cult found for us."
The humans were pressing negotiations hard, as was to be expected from a clan as desperate for allies as they. Already Thenanin forces had withdrawn from all areas of conflict with Earth and Timbrim, but the Terrigans were demanding much more than that in exchange for help managing and uplifting their new client race called Gorilla. In effect, they were demanding that the great clan of the Thenanin ally itself, with forlorn and despised wolflings and bad boy prankster Timbrimmy. This, at a time when the horrible Soro-Tandu alliance appeared to be unstoppable out on the Starlanes. Why, to do so might conceivably risk annihilation for the Thenanin themselves. If it were up to Buolt, who had had enough of Earthlings to last him a lifetime, the choice would be to tell them to go to Ifni's Hell and seek their allies there. But it was not up to Buolt. There had long been a strong minority streak of sympathy for Earth Clan back home. Colt's coup, allowing the Great Clan to achieve another treasured laurel of patronhood, could win that faction government soon. Under such circumstances, Buolt figured it was wise to keep his own opinions to himself. One of his under-commanders approached and saluted.
"We have determined the positions taken up by the Gubru Defense Flotilla," he reported. "They are clustered quite close to the planet. Their disbursement is unusual. Our battle computers are finding it very hard to crack."
Yes, Buolt thought on examining the close-in display. A brilliant arrangement of limited forces. Even original, perhaps. How unlike the Gubru.
"No matter," he huffed. "Even if there is no subtle way, they will nonetheless see that we came with more than adequate firepower to do the job by brute force, if necessary. They will concede. They must concede."
"Of course they must,"
the human admiral agreed. But she did not sound convinced. In fact, she seemed worried.
"We are ready to approach to fail-safe envelopment," the officer of the deck reported.
Buolt nodded quickly.
"Good. Proceed. From there we can contact the enemy and announce our intentions."
Tension built as the armada advanced closer to the system's modest yellow sun. Although the Thenanin claimed proudly to possess no psychic powers, Buolt seemed to feel the gaze of the Earthling woman upon him, and he wondered how it was possible that he found her so intimidating.
"She is only a wolfling," he reminded himself.
"Shall we resume our discussions, Commander?"
Admiral Alvarez asked at last.
He had no choice but to comply, of course. It would be best if much was decided before they arrived, and the siege manifesto was read aloud. Still, Buolt planned to sign no agreements until he had a chance to confer with Colt. That Thenanin had a reputation for vulgarity, and, well, frivolity, that had won him exile to this backwater world. But now he appeared to have achieved unprecedented miracles. His political power back home would be great. Buolt wanted to tap Colt's expertise, his apparent knack at dealing with these infuriating creatures. His aides and the human delegation filed out of the bridge toward the meeting room. But before Buolt left, he glanced one more time back at the situation tank and the deadly-looking Gubru battle array. Air noisily escaped his breathing slits. "What are the avians planning?" he wondered. "What shall I do if these Gubru prove to be insane?"
Chapter 105. Robert. In some parts of Port Helena, there were more guard drones than ever, protecting their masters' domains rigorously, lashing out at anyone who passed too near. Elsewhere, however, it was almost as if a revolution had already taken place.
The invaders' posters lay tattered in the gutters. Above one busy street corner, Robert glimpsed a new mural that had recently been erected in place of Gubru propaganda. Painted in the style called focalist realism, it depicted a family of gorillas staring with dawning but hopeful sentience out upon a glowing horizon, protectively standing beside them, showing the way to that wonderful future, was a pair of idealized, high-browed neo-chimpanzees. Oh yes, there had also been a human and a Thenanin in the picture, vague and in the background. Robert thought it really nice of the artist to have remembered to include them. The heavily guarded shuttle he was in passed through the intersection too quickly to see much detail, but he thought the rendering of the female chim hadn't quite done Galet justice. Fibbin, on the other hand, ought to be flattered. Soon the free parts of town were behind them, and they passed westward into areas patrolled with strict military discipline. When they landed, their taloned soldier guards hurried outside and stood watch as Robert and Uther Calding left the shuttle to climb the ramp leading to the shining new branch library. "This is an expensive setup, isn't it?" he asked the Timbrimi ambassador. "Do we get to keep it if the Thenanin manage to kick the birds out?" Uther Calding shrugged.
"Probably. And maybe the ceremonial mound as well. Your clan is due reparation, certainly."
"But you have your doubts." Uther Calding stood in the vast entranceway, surveying the vaulted chamber and the towering cubic data store within.
"It is just that I think it would be unwise to count your chickens before they have met the rooster."
Robert understood Uther Calding's point. Even defeat for the Gubru might come at unthinkable cost. "It's counting one's eggs before they're laid," he told the Timbrimi, who was always anxious to improve his grasp of Anglic metaphors. This time, however, Uther Calding didn't thank Robert. His widespread eyes seemed to flash as he looked back, sidelong.
"Think about it," he said.
Soon Uther Calding was deep in conversation with the Kantan chief librarian. At a loss to follow their rapid, inflected galactic, Robert started a circuit of the new library, taking its measure and looking at its current users. Except for a few members of the Grand Examiner's team, all of the occupants were avians. The Gubru present were divided by a gulf he could ken as well as see. Nearly two-thirds of them clustered over to the left. They cooed and cast disapproving glances at the smaller group, which consisted almost entirely of soldiers. The military did not give off happy vibrations, but they hid it well, strutting about their tasks with crisp efficiency, returning their peers' disapproval with arrogant disdain. Robert made no effort to avoid being seen. The wave of stares he attracted was pleasing. They obviously knew who he was. If just passing near caused an interruption in their work, so much the better. Approaching one cluster of Gubru, by their ribbons, obviously members of the priestly caste of propriety, he bowed to an angle he hoped was correct, and grinned as the entire offended gaggle was forced to form up and reply in kind. Finally, Robert came upon a data station formatted in a way he understood. Uther Calding was still immersed in conversation with the librarian, so Robert decided to see what he could find out on his own. He made very little progress. The enemy had obviously set up safeguards to prevent the unauthorized from accessing information about near space, or the presumably converging battle fleets of the Thenanin. Still, Robert kept on trying. Time passed as he explored the current data net, finding out where the invaders had set up their blocks.
So intense was his concentration that it took a while before he grew aware that something had changed in the library. Automatic sound dampers had kept the growing hubbub from intruding on his concentration, but when he looked up at last, Robert saw that the Gubru were in an uproar. They waved their downy arms and formed tight clusters around hollow tanks. Most of the soldiers had simply vanished from sight. What on Garth has gotten into them? He wondered. Robert didn't imagine the Gubru would welcome him peering over their shoulders. He felt frustrated. Whatever was happening, it sure had them perturbed. Hey, Robert thought. Maybe it's on the local news. Quickly he used his own screen to access a public video station. Until recently, censorship had been severe, but during the last few days, as soldiers were called away to combat duty, the networks had fallen under the control of the caste of Cost and Caution. Those glum, apathetic bureaucrats now hardly enforced even modest discipline. The tank flickered, then cleared to show an excited Chim reporter.
And so, at latest reports, it seems the surprise offensive from the Mulun hasn't yet engaged the occupation forces. The Gubru seem unable to agree on how to answer the manifesto of the approaching forces.
Robert wondered, had the Thenanin made their pronouncement of intent already? That had not been expected for a couple of days, at least. Then one word caught in his mind. From the Mulun?
We'll now rebroadcast the statement read just 5 minutes ago by the joint commanders of the army, right now marching on Port Helena.
The view in the hollow tank shifted. The Chim announcer was replaced by a recently recorded image showing three figures standing against a forest background. Robert blinked. He knew these faces, two of them intimately. One was a Chen named Benjamin. The other two were women he loved.
And so we challenge our oppressors. In combat we have behaved well, under the dicta of the Galactic Institute for Civilized Warfare. This cannot be said of our enemies. They have used criminal means and have allowed harm to non-combatant fallow species native to a fragile world. Worst of all, they have cheated.
Robert gaped. The image panned back to show platoons of Chims, bearing a motley assortment of weapons, trooping forth from the forest out into the open, accompanied by a few fierce-eyed humans. The one speaking into the camera was Lydia McHugh, Robert's human lover. But Athaclena stood next to her, and in his alien consort's eyes he saw and knew who had written the words. And he knew without any doubt whose idea this was.
We demand, therefore, that they send forth their best soldiers, armed as we are armed, to meet our champions out in the open, in the Valley of the Sindh.
Who's the calling? He said hoarsely. Then again louder. Who's the calling?
The noise suppressors had been developed by 100 million generations of librarians. But in all that time, there had been only a few wolfling races. For just an instant, the vast chamber echoed before dampers shut down the impolite vibrations and imposed hushed quiet once again. There was nothing, however, to be done about running in the halls. Chapter 106 Galen.
Recombatant rats!
Fibbon cried upon hearing the beginnings of the declaration. They watched a portable hollow set up on the slopes of the ceremonial mound. Galen gestured for silence.
Be quiet, Fibbon. Let me hear the rest of it.
But the meaning of the message had been obvious from the first few sentences.
Columns of irregulars, wearing makeshift uniforms of homespun cloth, marched steadily across open, winter-barren fields. Two squads of horse cavalry skirted the ragged army's perimeter, like escapees from some pre-contact flat movie. The marching Chims grinned nervously and watched the skies, fondling their captured or mountain-made weapons. But there was no mistaking their attitude of grim resolve. As the cameras panned back, Fibbin did a quick count.
"That's everybody," he said in awe. "I mean, allowing for recent casualties, it's everybody who's had any training or would be any good at all in a fight. It's all or nothing."
He shook his head.
"Clip my blue card if I can figure what she hopes to accomplish."
Galet glanced up at him.
"Some blue card," she sniffed. "And I'd have to say she knows exactly what she's doing, Fibbin." "But the city rebels were slaughtered out on the Sind."
She shook her head.
"That was then. We didn't know the score. We hadn't achieved any respect or status. Anyway, there weren't any witnesses."
"But the mountain forces have won victories. They've been acknowledged, and now the five galaxies are watching."
Galet frowned.
"Oh, Ethiclena knows what she's doing. I just didn't know things were this desperate."
They sat quietly for a moment longer, watching the insurgents advance slowly across orchards and winter-barren fields. Then Fibbin let out another exclamation.
"What?"
Galet asked. She looked where he pointed in the tank, and it was her turn to hiss in surprise. There, carrying a saber rifle along with the other Chim soldiers, strode someone they both knew. Sylvie did not seem uncomfortable with her weapon. In fact, she appeared an island of almost zen-like calm in the sea of nervous neo-chimpanzees.
"Who would have figured it?"
Galet thought.
"Who would have thought that about her?"
They watched together. There was little else they could do.